Well, the last thing I want to do is bore you with holiday snaps. So I'm going to try and whiz through this and not linger too long over every slide. But having gone on a pilgrimage to Israel, it felt selfish not to share it, because I did walk where Jesus walked at some point, although there's always some controversy about where the tomb is, where the angels were when the shepherds were on the hillside. But I'd like you to hopefully enjoy this, and if you want to talk to me about any of it afterwards, that would be great. For me, the Bible came alive, and for me it was a miracle to go. I didn't think I'd ever be able to afford to go, but somebody very kindly gifted me the opportunity to be able to go with a group of people, and with Trevor and Lisa, who we know are our dear friends from this congregation. So let's start if we can. Okay, I don't know, can everyone see that from there? Is that okay? When we arrived at the Arabic quarter of Jerusalem, and on the first morning we were trying to acclimatise, so the first job we had to do was walk up the Mount of Olives with a head that looked like a Swan Vestas match, and my head was very hot. We travelled up to the Mount of Olives and we had a panoramic view of Jerusalem. We visited various places, the Paternoster Church, chapel, Church of All Nations, and just to be on the Mount of Olives was quite amazing. We travelled on to the guest house to have lunch, and then arrived at the village of Ein Kerem, which was the birthplace of John the Baptist. Now, we had a very lively Israeli tour guide. His name was Lazarus, and he said, "Don't bother with the jokes, I've heard them all." But he was an amazing man with so much head knowledge to share. And because of him, we all had a terrific experience of getting to know in depth some of the geography of the places where Jesus had been. Whoops. But there's me, very hot, with Charlie's hat on. From the very top of the Mount of Olives, we walked down to see the panoramic view of Jerusalem. And you'll see, if you can, a shiny bit right in the middle on the left photo, which is the mosque, which is built over the birthplace, supposedly, of Christ. But the Muslims have taken over that spot and they have built a mosque over it. We were called to ask for prayer for peace in Jerusalem. Jerusalem suffers great conflict. And whilst we were there, we saw many bombs and rocket bombs coming over the top about 60 miles away. But we didn't feel unsafe. As our tour guide said, probably more chance of dropping dead in London than there is in Jerusalem. You might see some graves, also on the left-hand side and in the middle. The graves are full of the bodies of all of the Israelis that have ever come to Jerusalem. And it's a sacred and the largest Jewish cemetery in the world. King David declared it a cemetery 3,000 years ago when he made it the capital. And the cemetery holds 150,000 graves. They don't believe in cremation because they believe when Jesus comes again, he will raise the dead, so they need their bones. Quite an interesting concept. The Garden of Gethsemane. Now, this is where Lisa broke down and actually made it very clear by talking to us. It's where Christ made the choice whether to save. God, of course, had given him that job to go onto the cross and save us. And he was pressed. And our Israeli tour guide gave me another thought about the way that olives are pressed three times and Christ was pressed three times. The garden in Hebrew is called Gat Shamanai, which has been shortened to Gethsemane, or the oil press garden. Some of the trees here were very ancient. And this was the place, the original place. We knew this was the place, although some places we went to we weren't sure, but this was the place that Christ was. And it was the place where he was first pressed when Judas came, betrayed him and handed him over to the guards by a holy kiss. And in Luke 22:53, Jesus actually said to the guards, "This is your hour when darkness reigns." So this was the first pressing, like an olive is pressed the first time. The oil from the second press, generally from olive oil, is used for medicine. And we were reminded that Christ was flogged by torture instruments which ripped open his flesh. But the prophet Isaiah, in Isaiah 53:5, said, "By his wounds we are healed." Mike often says this when we're praying for people to be healed. But by his wounds we are healed. And that includes all types of healing. Jesus is our medicine. The second pressing of an olive is used for medical care. And the oil from the last press of the olive is used to make soap. It's the end of the product. And on the cross where Jesus suffered all the judgment and penalties of our sin, shed his blood, we were cleansed by his sins. So that's the third pressing of the olive, the soap. It's just something to remember, but it brings it to life for me. In John 1:7, it says that the blood of Jesus purifies us from our sin. And that's why God used that final press on Christ to purify us from our sin. You'll be pleased to know there's not as much text in the next few slides, I think. There were eight ancient olive trees growing in this Latin or Roman site, the Garden of Gethsemane, that were over 900 years old. An olive tree apparently never really dies. It goes to seed and comes back again. I found that amazing. But the average life of an olive tree is 500 years old. And it's very revered and owned by the Franciscan community. We walked down into Jerusalem. And when we walked down, it was the path that Christ would have walked on the wild donkey when he was going towards being revered, and palm crosses and palms were waved. Hosanna was said. And we came to this church, which is called the Church of All Nations or the Basilica of the Agony. Now, this was a very holy place for many different types of Christians, but the Armenian Christians really are there ever present, and they stand around the Stone of Agony. And so this picture at the bottom, which I didn't take because you're not allowed to, is from the media. And you can see 24/7 there are people praying at that stone where Jesus prayed the night before his death. And surrounding it is a circle of thorns made of wrought iron, which is all around as a collage, really, on the wall. It was a very moving place to be. And we moved on to the Church of St. Peter, which of course is near, because it wasn't far from there that Peter denied Christ three times. And there's a very large Scottish guest house there where we had lunch, but it's dedicated to St. Peter. And if you can just see, there's a cockerel on the very top there on the dome, which is obviously the cockerel to remind us that the cockerel crowed three times. And this was where Peter had denied Christ, around this area. Now, also there's a statue here which has got a bit of poetic license, but the inscription reads on the statue, "But he denied him not, saying, 'Woman, I know him not.'" This was Peter talking. So here you've got the cockerel, the maid, and a Roman soldier just on the right-hand side. But here is a view of the lower caves where Jesus was held in custody, as well as Peter and John after his resurrection. That's all in Acts 5. The lower room is a place where visitors stand and pray. Again, it's a vigil. It seems like always, as Lazarus told us, that there are people there who are remembering that point where he was held in custody. It was very moving to go through this. It's very hard to give it justice by showing these photos, but many of us were moved to tears. And here you see the 2,000-year-old, or just over 2,000-year-old stone, the pavement, and the area which is called the Lithostrotos, which in Greek means the pavement. This is the original pavement Christ would have walked on whilst he was being tried and in custody. And when they were building a convent over it, they found this pavement. It was excavated, and everywhere you go, there's excavation. It's just north of the Temple Mount, and the trial of Jesus took place in the Praetorium of Jerusalem, which was a fortress built by King Herod. King Herod was quite a wicked king, but this is where Jesus was moved around. And towards the end of the trial, the judge Pontius Pilate, as we know, showed Jesus to the public, discussed his guilt, and the Gospel of John records, when Pilate heard this, he brought Jesus out and sat down on the judge's seat at a place known as the stone pavement, which in Aramaic is Gabbatha. And these large flagstones even had board games chiselled on them to amuse the Romans whilst they were taking people for trial. To the side of it is the Struthium Pool, which is known as the Sparrow Pool. And this, there's a big water system in Jerusalem. There's a shortage of water, so they held water in cisterns. This cistern was built by Herod in 1 AD. Everything that's so ancient is well preserved and looked after, because nobody really knew which part Christ may have gone to, and nobody wanted to play around with it. This pool was very deep, known as Sparrow Pool, and it was the smallest of many water cisterns that held the city together and really allowed them to have clean water. In the pools, quite often, people bathed as well as drank that water, which I found quite strange, but that's how it was. We moved on to a model of ancient Jerusalem. This was just the first day. We covered about 8 miles the first day. We were hot, but we tried hard to take the opportunity to listen, because many of us will never go there again. So this is massive. I can't do this justice, actually. It's a massive field. It's a recreation of the Second Temple period. The First Temple period was when Solomon was around 1200 to 588 BC. Around that period is the First Temple period. He didn't live that long. King David conquered Jerusalem. He made it the capital. But it was destroyed by King Nebuchadnezzar in 586. And the king of Babylon conquered Jerusalem. There's a tunnel that was built to try and stop the enemy from coming, to try and divert the water, called Hezekiah's Tunnel. And during this sort of Second Temple period, the Persians were in charge, the Hellenistic, the Greek people were in charge, there was a Roman period in charge, all ruling over Jews. But Herod, because he had a very big ego, decided to enlarge the Temple Mount, and he rebuilt the temple according to public agreement. I'm not sure if they really did agree. And so during the Second period, Jesus was alive. So we hear of the temple because Jesus was around. It went from about 586 before Christ to 70 years after Christ. The Jews came back to it. They came back from exile. They were in Babylon. And the king of Persia allowed this to happen. And Jesus died, well, really 40 years, I think it was, before the temple was destroyed. And of course, some Jews believe the third temple will come. So some Jews are holding the stones and the remnants of the temple to build a third temple. But of course, we know Jesus is the temple, and his return, his coming, won't need another physical building. We also went to see the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, I don't know what I really expected. It was a very sort of cold building because they have to hold it at a temperature. Many of the scrolls are original, but some are copies. because they deteriorated. But in the state they are now, they expect they can keep them well for many years. And they were discovered between 1947 and 1956 in 11 caves near Kirbet Qumran, just on the northwest shore of the Dead Sea. And they're about 2,000 years old, dating from 3rd to 1st BC, before Christ. And they contain fragments of about 31 scrolls, written on papyrus, which was made out of a plant, and included Genesis, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, 1 Kings, Psalms, Daniel, and some hymns. This one in particular, I took a picture of this one. This is around 150 years before Christ, the oldest known copy of the book of Isaiah. You have to pinch yourself because you think, I'm actually looking at the original manuscript. The original. It's not something from a Bible that I'm reading. And these were found, they say, by a young boy, but our tour guide said that the Bedouins who live in the desert knew they were there, but they didn't tell anybody. And they were found mainly in sort of water carrier urns, that type of thing. And originally, they were used as the manual of discipline. I had to really think about that. So it wasn't the Bible, obviously, at that point. It was the manual of discipline. We then passed into the Zion Gate and went into the old city, which is what I'd been waiting for, to get into the city. Our hotel faced one of the walls of the city of Jerusalem. It's like a circle almost inside. It's like you go in a labyrinth and it's cut into quarters. So this is known as the most holy site in the Jewish faith. It's the last bit of the wall of the Second Temple, and probably completed by Herod 18 years before Christ. This is the original bit of the wall up here, and they've rebuilt an exit to come out of the city of Jerusalem. It was very busy. There were cleaning machines. There were people selling bits of food. There were plastic toys being sold. And I thought, wow, this is so busy. But people live in there and they work in there. And it's cooler because the walls are high and the walls are thick. But to the right, you'll see what they call the Wailing Wall or the Western Wall. This is an extension of the rest of the wall, which the Jews use for prayer and meditation and to read their holy book. And they go there separated, men from women. I had to struggle to get down there. The women are very cautious about Western women coming down. You have to put your shawl, you have to cover your head. You approach the wall, you ask permission as you go through. And I put a very small prayer into a crack in the wall for my daughter-in-law, who I can now say is pregnant and 20 weeks pregnant. We thought she was going to lose the baby, but God is very gracious to us. And I do believe that faith helps in these situations. So I took it upon myself to do that. But the women just sit there with their plastic garden chairs, take up residence for the day. The men also are backs and forwards because they're working, most of them. They had the long tassels to remind them to pray every day. They have the special hairstyle with the ringlets. They don't particularly cut their hair. They have very tall black hats. And they have black suits and white shirts. They race around. They're always trying to get to prayer or get to work or see their family. And it's an amazing place to go. It feels a really holy and spiritual place to be. We moved on to look at one of the pools, the Pool of Bethesda. This is in John, it's in the Gospels, where Jesus heals the paralytic man. It's a complex site. It's still being excavated. And this was a mikveh, M-I-K-V-E-H, or a ritual bath place. So if you were a man and you were a Jew, you could go down and you could wash yourself before you entered into time of prayer. And it's obviously one of Jesus' miracle places. But it's been built over. Many places in Jerusalem are knocked down and built with the same stones in a new way, with chapels and churches. We then went on to the Via Dolorosa, which is the Latin word for way of suffering. and we followed the 14 stations of the cross. Does anyone here know about the 14 stations? Yeah. Mike, do you want to tell us about the 14 stations of the cross? Because I haven't written it down, and he's probably got more knowledge than I have.
The stations of the cross were sort of developed by the Catholic Church way back. I mean, it was the only church in those days. That's how church history started. The church that started from the apostles developed over the next 200 or 300 years into what became the Western Catholic Church. And there are 14 points on Jesus' journey carrying the cross, from the point when he's given the cross to the point when he's actually crucified. And he goes down this Via Dolorosa, the sorrowful way, the way of sorrows. And so if you go into a Catholic church, you will see down both sides of the church and on the wall, there are the pictures of these stations. And there will be probably seven down one side and seven up the other side. And each one depicts something that happened to Jesus. So, for example, there's Jesus falls under the weight of the cross is one of them. And there's another one where he falls a second time under the weight of the cross. And there are various ones. There are some that they've added that are not in the Bible, which is interesting. There's one where he meets Veronica, Saint Veronica, and the legend was that she wiped his face, and his picture was on her thing that she wiped with, you know. Now that's not in the Bible, but that's added in, you know. And so the stations of the cross. During Lent, high Anglican churches and Roman Catholic churches have a service around Stations of the Cross. And so they will process around the church and stop at each station. They say all these sort of prayers. They say Hail Marys, they say the Lord's Prayer, and the Glory Be to the Father. They're the three prayers they use. And then the priest will just say something about that particular station. And the idea is supposed to be that people meditate, you know, when they're seeing this, they're thinking about it, meditating. So if you go to a Catholic church during Lent, you'll find that they're doing the Stations of the Cross. But it's all based on what Jesus did on that last journey. It's quite a moving thing, actually. I mean, if you can dump some of the nonsense around it, it's actually quite a moving thing to think about what Jesus did, you know, and to follow that way of the cross.
Thank you. I'm sorry to ask, Susan, could you check the potatoes? Oh, thank you. That's not part of the talk, but there we are. I can only say it was a very moving thing to go around the streets and see all of these particular parts of Jesus' journey. We did go to, I'm not sure about this, but I took a picture of it. I'm not sure if it's the real thing, but the Church of St. Anne was built around 450 AD, so it's about 1,500 years old. The Crusaders visited Jerusalem, as did the Muslims, but the Crusaders preserved churches as well and also built some new ones. It marks the site of Jesus' maternal grandparents, Anne and Joachim, and the birthplace of the Virgin Mary. But it's very quiet and peaceful. And when you're on a hot, dusty road and you're walking a long time, it really is like an oasis. We went in and we sang. We had an impromptu service. We had a director of music with us. And he helped us to sing a couple of songs with a 7-second echo, which, unless you're actually singing it, you can't quite describe. But it's a bit like having a microphone with an echo. So it was amazing. And different churches were allowed 10 minutes in there to hear themselves sing, really. The Church of the Holy Sepulchre, again, one of the very holy sites. It's in the Christian Quarter, so we crossed from Arabic to Christian Quarter. It's home to two of the holy sites, the site where Jesus was crucified and the tomb where Jesus was buried and resurrected. There are two tombs. You have to make your choice. Today, the tomb's enclosed by a shrine called the Iadocula, and that's where we saw the final four stations of the cross. So the via goes into there and finishes off there. We touched the top of Golgotha. Golgotha is it's like a large rock face around where Jesus was crucified. You had to sort of get down on your knees and get through something to put your hand on it, if you chose to do so. Then we entered the garden tomb, which was absolutely wonderful. We believe this is the garden tomb where Jesus was actually laid. So in the middle it says, "I am the light of the world," but it's not very clear on focus there. But on the wall is this graffiti, might appeal to the youth. The first Greek Christian graffiti from the Byzantine period, which was 500 years after the second temple was built. That's where Jesus lay, to the left. I was able to get my camera in to actually take a picture without the railings. That's the spot where we think he was laid. And to the right is the entrance to the tomb. Nobody speaks in there. There are shackles on the wall, and the pins where the Romans would have put people's arms up if they hadn't quite died. They would finish them off by just leaving them hanging up. Very torturous and very barbaric. But again, a place where it really moved you. And just outside is a similar stone to the one that would have been rolled away. Just left there for us to think on. And it just brought to mind this verse. "Now in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden, a new sepulchre, wherein was never man yet laid." Earlier on, we spoke about Joseph of Arimathea. We didn't speak it. We sung it in a song, that he gave his tomb to allow that body to be laid and for it to be given precious oils. And actually, this has never been broken. This has never been knocked to the ground, because people, I think, are fearful of doing that. So it's remained as the garden tomb. In the middle there, you'll see that something that looks like a face. I've tried to put some arrows, so there's some eyes. The nose has fallen off, and there's a sort of bit of a mouth going on. It looks like a skull, which is Golgotha, the place of the skull. And to the right is the cistern, where potentially the women who went to preserve Jesus' body would have fetched water to have helped them in the process of trying to keep the body good in the tomb. And of course we know the body wasn't there eventually. Following day we got up and went to Masada, a long trip out to the desert. This was built because Herod was not very popular, and he was a bit scared that the revolts were coming and he was going to be got at, so he found a place to run away to. Most people who are despots or evil will find a hiding place, and this was a hiding place out in the desert, a fortress. Many people died making it. We went up by a cable car, and when I say went up, there were 50 of us in a very small cable car. We were squashed against the edge. And I said, "I can't get in." The man went, "You're getting in." So I got in, and it was literally like that, but worth it, because when you got to the top, and it had to be the top because it's a fortress built up high in the desert, it was worth it. There's a story here. It's called The Siege of Masada. And if you like films, you can watch it. It's just called Masada. Look it up on Netflix or whatever. It will be there. And it tells the story of the people who were Jewish zealots, people who had run away because they were going to get killed by Romans, and they'd taken on this fortress because it wasn't used, had lots of food, had lots of water. Herod was planning maybe to go there. And they took it over. And what happened was, towards the end of the war, the Roman army wanted that back. They wanted to get that fortification back. The siege lasted between 4 and 7 months. When we looked over the side, the ramp had been built up the side of the fortress, and many people had died doing it, but they'd managed to get it up to the top of the fortress. Knowing that, the Jews didn't want to be there when they arrived, so they were trained at killing. They killed each other, even the women and children, because they would have been taken and abused. But there was one person left. So not to commit suicide, supposedly, he fell on his sword to die. So when the Romans arrived, nobody was there, and they were shocked. But they didn't want to be taken by the Romans. They made that choice. It was very sad. But 2 women, 5 children were left, and they were telling the tale in order for us to be able to talk about it now. And it was recorded by Flavius Josephus, so we know it to be true. A little bit boring, but here we go. A few pots. I happen to like pots. I like the British Museum. And a fish that got caught somehow in the rock. Over 2,000 years old, that fossil of a fish. In this place were also 2 scrolls of Leviticus and Deuteronomy, and 2 more manuscripts of Psalms. So I think they must have taken some of their holy scriptures with them when they got there. And this is a drone view of the palace. On the left, waving around. It was built on natural terraces, but all carved out of rock. Amazing. I don't know how they did it. And there were 2 palaces. Both were well stocked up with goods to survive out there for some period. And there was a reception hall. I mean, he entertained people here. And there was a terrace at the bottom for receptions and banquets. And there was a beautiful bathhouse there as well. Went on to the Dead Sea. Now, the Dead Sea, for me, was an amazing place. I couldn't sink. I didn't want to sink, but I couldn't have sunk if I wanted to. So that guy decided to read his paper and keep his shoes on, because at the bottom it's very sharp. It's like coral that you're walking on, and salt balls. I bought one back. I don't think you're supposed to, but I bought it back. It looks like a marble, but that's how it goes. The salt forms that way. It's the lowest point on earth. You can't get any lower, so therefore it's starting to shrink. It's getting sucked up by the sun, basically, and it's becoming more salty as it goes. We could wash off afterwards, which was good. On the side here, another thing built out of rock was St. George's Monastery, and that's a sort of respite place for people who are on long journeys in the desert. But also, part of the road of Jerusalem to Jericho. Can anyone think what that might be significant for? Jerusalem to Jericho? It's one of the parables. The Good Samaritan. So they decided to build this, the monks, to allow people to have some rest, a resting point, just like the Bible talks about, a place where the Samaritan took the injured person and he was looked after. It was very, very windy up there. 2 people lost their hats and 1 person nearly fell off. So it was quite an interesting place to be. Okay, I've just got to find my note here, so it won't be a moment. Yeah. Okay, so we went on to the place where the announcement was made to the shepherds. And there was a grotto underground. We had a service in there. But it was so beautiful, the actual church. It was thought this is the place where the angels came and announced the birth. And some more frescoes. These were done only about 150 years ago, but underneath were some more original ones. And that marks the place where the angels first announced the birth of Christ. We were in Palestine. Very interesting to go to Palestine from Jerusalem, because you get on a coach and you have to have your passport and your visa, and you have to hold it up while Palestinian soldiers get on your coach with their machine guns and search and look and check all your documents are in order. Our Israeli tour guide was the most scared, because obviously they don't like the Israelis, but he was allowed to come with us because he was leading the tour. But I did feel for him. You could even hear it in his voice as he was asking us to do everything we were told to do. And then they got off and said, "Have a lovely holiday," which is really bizarre. We got to meet some Bedouin people because we were near the desert, and the Bedouins really are the people of the desert. They're also called many other things, but I can't pronounce the words because you have to use the back of your throat for that. But they live in the Negev desert. They've lived there for thousands and thousands of years, and they're in charge of many things like animal herding, the agriculture, grazing, and most importantly, camels. And the camels were very entertaining. They were spitting everywhere and kicking their back legs, so we didn't really get near them. We were taken to a restaurant owned by Bedouins, which is in the middle. Obviously not a real Bedouin place to eat, but an example. Very luxurious, with lots of curtaining, and very cool. They certainly know how to use the winds to keep themselves cool. Into Nazareth, which isn't far from where we were, and we went to a living museum, which meant people actually did live there and acted out the roles that people would have lived in that village. So we were shown many things, farming, how to make wine, how to press olives, pottery, etc., etc., and we had a meal there too, which was a genuine meal of that time. We looked at the various ways they made colour, because really there wasn't a lot of colour going on in that civilization, and how they had to crush mollusks to be able to get a purple dye. And once they'd got that dye, it would never fade. So it was more costly than gold to have a purple outfit. Often we look at colours on stained glass windows, but you'll see Jesus often in a sort of purple or a white colour. And there would have been a donkey, not a person, tethered to that millstone. One of our people in our trip just decided to push it round to show us how it worked. On to the Church of the Basilica, which is the grotto of the Nativity and the site of the manger and Christ's birth. Obviously very near, because the shepherds weren't that far away when they came over to where the manger was. And there's an unusual top on that church on the right-hand side. It's called a cupola. This is where they think the home of the Virgin Mary was, aged about maybe 14, when she became the mother of the Son of God. And here she uttered the consent, "Let it be done to me according to your word." And the outcome of Mary's consent is carved in Latin across the facade. The word was made flesh and dwelt among us. That's carved in the rock. The word was made flesh and dwelt among us. Okay, getting to the end of the journey now. We looked at the grotto of the Nativity, which is inside that church. We were allowed to crawl underneath the picture in the middle. It's a bit like a fireplace, but we were allowed to crawl in there, and there's like a star shape. And if you put your hand on it, that's the roundabout, they think, where Christ was born. And it's very quiet. You don't make any noise. You just move quietly. Being short, I was able to get underneath it, but some people couldn't. I was quite pleased about that, because normally being short isn't a great thing, but on this occasion it was. And it's marble, the floor, and on the floor it says, "Hic de Virgine Maria Jesus Christus natus est." Here Jesus Christ was born to the Virgin Mary. And there are some steps which then take you down. On the right-hand side, there's a picture there, to a place called the Iconostasis, the carved green standing in front of the main altar. And we led it down by our guide to the subterranean cave. And on the right-hand side, that's what we found. It was beautiful. And it's actually underneath where Jesus would have been. Now, Jesus would have probably been born, according to our guide, in a cave, down where the animals were, because it was warmer. And it was the place where most people kept their animals. So when they couldn't find room, it was ideal in a way for them to have the protection and the warmth down there. I wouldn't have thought so myself as a mother, but for Mary, that's how it happened. And these were our final couple of days. We were taken to Sea of Galilee. We stayed there 3 days. We swam in the sea, took a boat, etc. But this was the place where the loaves and the fishes were distributed. And so there's a church called Church of the Multiplication of the Loaves and the Fishes. It's rather beautiful. It's very peaceful. And according to Matthew 14, the miraculous feeding came after Jesus learned that Herod Antipas had beheaded his cousin, John the Baptist. Jesus withdrew in a boat to a deserted place, but of course the crowds wouldn't leave him. They followed, and he had compassion. He cured their sickness, but in the evening, he told the multitude to sit on the grass, and he took 5 loaves and 2 fish, and he broke them, and the disciples gave them to the crowds. And we all remember that there were 12 baskets of food left afterwards, and of course more than 5,000 men. There were women and children. It was a very moving place to be, so we decided to have a service. We had to book the space, and this is on the beach called Tagbar Beach. It was so beautiful to just sit there and feel the peace. And again, we'd moved further down at this point. We were sitting where the 153 fish had been caught when Jesus said, "Cast your nets." The disciples dragged the net ashore. They found Jesus had cooked them breakfast on a charcoal fire. So this was the area where Jesus had cooked something for their breakfast. And it was known as the Mensa Christ, or the Table of Christ. We took communion there. There were many tears because the Spirit moved a lot in the group we were with. And the Holy Spirit really blessed us and gave our eyes a way of being open to this area and our hearts to receive it. So our leader there was Mark. You can see him on the left. And there were 33 in our party taking communion that day. We went on to have lunch. I had to take a picture of the fish. Sorry, it's not very scriptural, but it was interesting because people don't often eat fish this way anymore. But it came out of the water and onto our plate, so it was very fresh. This is the Mount of Beatitudes. This is the place where the Sermon on the Mount was delivered. Very serene, very quiet, overlooking the Sea of Galilee. And really it was also the place where Jesus did a lot of his ministry, including the town of Capernaum. Just below this is Sower's Cove, which it is believed is the area where Jesus taught the parable of the sower from a boat moored in the bay. Would anyone read for me the Beatitudes? I think it would be good to hear them. Would anyone be prepared? Daniela, would you come up to do that?
Sorry. Matthew 5, verse 3 to 12, in the Sermon on the Plain, and in Luke 6, verse 20 to 23. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be satisfied. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called children of God. Blessed are those who suffer persecution for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Amen.
Thank you. We read that whilst we were there, and again, very moving. What was good was we had somebody with us who was just so gifted in music and had a guitar, so we could just open up and sing appropriately wherever we were. And that was an amazing thing to have as part of the pilgrimage. So we were just coming to the end of our trip now, and we were walking. we were walking around the convent that was nearby, and we saw these two sculptures of Christ resting, and it just reminded me how much we need rest. I'm not very good at it, talking to myself, but we need rest, and we need rest in God, and today is the day of the Lord, which is to rest. And so part of coming to church and eating together later is part of resting with each other and having fellowship with each other. So I'm looking forward to that later. So we went on to Caesarea, which was our final place, really. It was the last sort of few hours before we caught the plane. And it's on the Med coast. It's beautiful. It's an artificial port. It was built by very many civilizations who came there. But Herod had a big part to play in building it. It's often called City of Jesus because Jesus was there quite a bit. And they restored the amphitheatre there. And they used the amphitheatre for concerts. I think that night Sting were going there, or Police, or one of those sort of retro groups were going there to perform. There was an aqueduct because water was very important to the Romans, and burial tombs called sarcophagi, just to the right. I had never really understood what they were, but the Israelis don't believe in putting, the Israelites don't believe in putting bodies away without preserving them and then waiting for them to liquefy, and then the bones are kept and put in a box called an ossuary. And so often there are family tombs, like sarcophagi, where you put your boxes of family bones, basically, and then you can get them out if you want to remember them. But lime is in the stone, and lime helps to degrade the body, and obviously the heat as well. And it's a protector over the people's bodies to put them in these things. You couldn't lift the stone on the top. They're sarcophagus, but many of them are sarcophagi. Our guide was very pedantic. We had to keep learning all these different words, so I still have them running around my head. So here you've got the half amphitheatre. And in the 4th century, this was used a lot. Because of military battles that were fought, and because they were thinking of ways to entertain, they would flood the gallery in the amphitheatre, not the gallery, the floor, and then they would create, I suppose it must have been quite interesting, like model boats and ships, and then they would have sticks and move them around to show how they won various battles. A bit like boys' toys, maybe, I don't know. But it might have appealed more to a man than a woman, but it was an entertainment. The city began to deteriorate in the 7th century after the Muslims arrived. The Crusaders took it, and then in the 13th century, the Mamluks. The Mamluks were very barbaric. When they struck somewhere, they just razed everything to the ground. They just smashed it up, basically. So it had to keep being rebuilt. And it became the capital of Rome, of Judea, in 6 CE. Now, the reason I put CE is, it's not BC AD in Israel. It's Common Era, or before Common Era. Common Era, I think, meaning after Christ was born, because we became part of Christianity with the Jews, and before was just specific to the Jews. Subsequently, it was an important area of, it was an important centre of early Christianity, and it's mentioned in Acts. Caesarea is mentioned in Acts many times. Another 2,000-year-old floor. I'm fascinated by floors. But just to think they still survive is amazing. And that was me saying goodbye. But it was an absolutely amazing journey. And the thing that I came around to really understanding was the Lord is risen. He is risen indeed. And Jesus died for us to be able to live with him in eternity. And that's what I kept thinking. So this was Charlie's favourite verse, so I thought I'd honour him and put it in today. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believeth in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. The stone has been rolled away. We access heaven because of Jesus. And it was an amazing trip to be able to do. Thank you for listening. Sorry if it was a bit long, but I hope that it wasn't, and I hope there's something of interest there. Thank you.
Thank you, Sue. I've